take their seats so that we can be assured we have a quorum and we can begin late. I see one of our members can't hear me. Welcome to the Senate Health Human Services Finance and Policy Committee for today, January 19th, 2019. Welcome back, everybody. I see some members are not here yet, but we're going to do introductions. We do have a new lead on this committee. One of our colleagues, Senator Lori, is going to be visiting with us, but on the other side of the table, and we'll have the opportunity to visit with him many times, I'm sure, over the course of the year. But welcome, Senator Marty, as our new lead. Not inexperienced in the lead role and certainly not inexperienced on health and human services. I'm going to have everybody do introductions because we also have a new Republican on the committee. Senator Fischbach is no longer in the Senate, and so we have Senator Dreheim. So I'm going to ask us to start with Senator Dreheim. We'll just go around the table with brief reminders for anybody new in the room.
Thank you, Chair. Rich Dreheim, I'm the senator from Le Sueur, Scott, and Rice counties.
Senator Matt Klein, representing Mendota High.
Senator Chris Eaton, representing Brooklyn Center and southern part of Brooklyn Park.
Melissa Wickland, and I represent Bloomington and Richfield.
Good afternoon, Senator Rosen, and I represent a large portion of southern Minnesota.
Senator Scott Jensen, I represent Carver County.
I am Bailey Strand. I am Senator Benson's committee legislative assistant.
Andrea Todd Harlan. I'm the committee administrator.
Michelle Benson, Senator for parts of Anoka, Sherburne, and Isantee County.
Katie Kavanaugh, the Senate counsel for this committee.
John Marty, Senator from Roseville, three other suburbs near north of St. Paul and part of St. Paul.
Hi, my name is Jeff Hayden. I'm state senator from South Minneapolis.
And Jim Abler from God's Country, otherwise known as Anoka.
Andrew Matthews from a better part of God's Country in Malacca. I represent Mille Lacs County, large pieces of Sherburne and Benton County, and a chunk of Wright, Morrison, and Kennebec counties.
Well, thank you all very much for being here, helping us start relatively timely, Senator Abler. He's not even listening to me now. So procurement has been a conversation for a couple of years, but we're getting to the point where DHS is going to go out for procurement. We'd like to hear some details of that so the committee is fully engaged and aware of what the steps will be. There was some controversy about the way that counties were rated in the last process, and so I think DHS has learned from that process. And so if I could invite Mr. Weiner and Ms. Marquardt, Ms. Weiner and Ms. Marquardt to join us. Thank you for taking time to prepare this presentation. And it's been a while since we've talked about procurement, so I hope you'll start by orienting us to what this managed care procurement process is and then what steps you anticipate the department taking. Welcome to committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Julie Marquardt. I'm the Director of Purchasing and Service Delivery Division at DHS.
And I'm PJ Weiner. I'm the Manager for Alternate Purchasing Strategies here at DHS.
So, Madam Chair and committee members, we are I think we're planning to do just what you had outlined. I'm going to go through a little bit of the background and history of managed care generally, just to reorient people if they're not familiar with the process or what it has looked like and our long history with managed care in this state. And then PJ is going to go into more detail around how a procurement is really carried out by the department and focusing on these upcoming procurements that are going to be occurring during 2019. And then we're happy to answer then at that point any questions that anyone may have for us. So just to reorient that managed care is a purchasing strategy. We generally use two different ways that we purchase care for enrollees on public programs. One is fee-for-service, which is simply providers are enrolled directly with DHS. They bill DHS directly for care enrollees receive, and we pay those claims. The second purchasing strategy, which is the one we're going to talk about, is we purchase through managed care organizations. We currently have eight contracts with eight different managed care organizations that serve different parts of the state and different counties. In that strategy, we set rates, and then we pay that monthly capitation payment to a managed care organization who then in turn enrolls the providers and pays those claims. And so at a very high level, that's the main difference. Within the managed care organizations, there are some things that that we do get that we don't get in a fee-for-service structure. And so we, within managed care, they have the ability to create provider networks that they can use to direct patients to maybe a little bit smaller network that's based on different indicators that they may determine what will serve that population of enrollees that they are responsible for perhaps better. The other thing they can do is they can negotiate rates. In the fee-for-service structure, the legislature sets the rates for us, and we pay the rates that the legislature has set. Within managed care, they do have the ability, by and large, to negotiate those rates with providers. And so that is an arrangement that is between the managed care organization and their contracted providers. And then within a managed care framework, there includes care coordination, programs like disease management, focus on high-cost, complex cases, some activities that generally in the fee-for-service environment we don't do. There are about 75% of our enrollees are covered under the managed care arrangement, so it's a very large part of our programs. And it's just, I think it's important to note that our Minnesota Care program is required under the federal basic health plan regulations. We have to deliver that program through a managed care arrangement. So within managed care, it doesn't cover everybody on the program, or not all populations are covered under managed care. The largest population is our families and children. The vast majority of children are in this program. It's about 800,000 people total, and on the slide you can see it's almost evenly distributed between the 7-county metro area and greater Minnesota. So the population is about almost 50% in each, with the metro just being just slightly more population in that. And then we have adults with disabilities. We have contracts that cover if you've heard the term special needs basic care, that is the adults with disabilities contract. And then seniors are the other population. Sometimes we refer to those two populations together as special needs products. So if you hear that term, we're usually referring to those two populations. And then families and children is where the medical assistance program is, but then that also covers the Minnesota Care program is within that families and children contract. So just to kind of orient our programs to these products. Then finally, we just wanted to give you some history of managed care in Minnesota and to really point out that a lot of people, I think, forget that we've been employing managed care as a strategy since the 80s. We predated even the managed care regulations at the federal level. So we just wanted to give some timeline to different things that have happened so that we were doing managed care before Minnesota Care even existed. It became part of our federal waiver in the mid-90s. We, as many of you know, did our first competitive price bid in 2011, and that kind of started that reform around how do we drive more value on the price side, but also look at quality. And then we did Medicaid expansion, which then changed our populations, and you have to accommodate that within a managed care framework. And then in 2015, the Minnesota Care program converted to the basic health program. So that changed some of the requirements. It's no longer part of our Medicaid program, no longer a waiver. Part of our waiver, it is actually under a different set of federal regulations. So sometimes what we can do in one program, we can no longer do in another or vice versa. And then I'll let PJ go through a little bit more on the details of actual, what happens during a procurement and the procurements that are going to be upcoming.
Madam Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Madam Chair, would it be possible for us, before we shift speakers, to go ahead and just ask a couple questions?
Okay, Senator Jensen, let's try to keep it tight. We're going to have time for questions at the end, so if there are specific things related to that speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation, and already I think you've hit on some really good points. Could we just go back to slide 3 when you talked about the state contracts with managed care organizations to deliver provider networks and payment arrangements? When you make payment arrangements, are they typically at what rate? What's your conversion factor? Or do you do it off of a reference based to Medicare? Because in my experience, clearly the fee schedule isn't very good. And then the other question I would have is, when managed care organizations receive the per member per month payments from you folks, do you know how much they receive and then how much they're paying out? And I guess in a sense I'm asking, sort of for their medical loss ratio. And are there specific limitations? Because I get more questions on this specific issue from providers and hospitals. And I think there's just there's a suspicion out there. And if we can eliminate the suspicion, that would be great. I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Ms. Marquardt. Madam Chair, with respect to the question about fee schedules, in fee-for-service, the legislature has set forth what our rates are and our payment methods. So in fee-for-service, we do use a resource-based relative value system. We determine the conversion factors. They were determined by and large back in 2010 when we implemented that, and it was required to be budget neutral. The plans do not have to use that same method. There are a few instances where our contracts, because the legislature has required us to be more prescriptive about how payments, what those payment arrangements and managed care look like. But by and large, for most services, they can set a different fee schedule. They could use some basis of their commercial rates. They could use some basis of Medicare rate. They could use fee-for-service as the base and do something with that. So there's a variety of arrangements that are out there. And we do get in counterclaims from the health plans. So the claims that they are paying, they do provide us a copy of that claim is also submitted to DHS.
Follow-up question, please, Madam Chair.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. We always worry about gaming. Is there any opportunity for the MCOs, the managed care organizations, to request more money than they're originally going to get on the per member per month basis because the index of severity of the people they're caring for is greater or that their costs were higher? Because one of the things that I worry about is that they might be receiving services or having the people that they're responsible for receiving services, such as an MRI, at a center that's clearly more costly than perhaps another center. And that makes me nervous that their motivation may not be to necessarily get the best price. It may be to swell the total price tag so that they can request a percentage back. Can you help put my mind at ease there?
Ms. Marquardt.
I don't want to, Madam Chair, I'm not going to say that there's gaming. I think that's a strong word. I do think that we are certainly interested, and I think we share that we want to make sure that the costs that we're building into those rates are the actual costs and that they represent appropriate cost effectiveness, that we're aiming toward high value but cost effective services throughout the system, whether that's fee for service or managed care. So we do audits of that encounter information. They are required to file financial reports, so we get financial data, and we get encounter claims. And so there's a reconciliation of that. And then there are the legislative auditor also conducts reviews of the managed care organization's financial information. So it is a place that we have paid particular attention. And I know the legislature has certainly in past years helped to shape what is allowable and what is unallowable within those costs. What can we incorporate into the rates and what can't we? But we are always looking for ways to ensure that that's exactly what we're doing.
Thank you. Please proceed with your presentation.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. So then we'll move into the upcoming procurement, and we thought we'd start with a little bit about what procurement is. Procurement is the process that we use to determine which health plans will participate in the medical assistance and Minnesota Care programs. The health plans respond to a request for proposals that is issued by DHS. And then DHS, the Department of Health, and counties score the proposals to determine who will be offered a contract. And the proposals will be evaluated on quality and service delivery, and in certain circumstances do contain a price component as well. And then the final decision on contracts are made by the DHS commissioner. And each time we do this, we're asked why we go through this process of re-procuring the contracts. And the first reason is that we are required under federal law to have competitive procurements, and then under state law to re-procure these contracts every 5 years. But more importantly, the process ensures that we are getting the highest quality care for the best value. And that's important because our managed care contracts cost more than $5 billion annually. So we've included in the slide deck here a couple of the maps that show our current landscape of which health plans participate throughout the state in various different areas. This is also available on our website. This is kind of small in the printout. This is what the landscape looks like in our Families and Children Medical Assistance Program. And then our next slide shows our Minnesota Care contracts. And we also have our two seniors programs, our Minnesota Senior Care Plus and Minnesota Senior Health Options. And as Julie mentioned earlier, program for adults with disabilities, our special needs basic care contracts. So we've included our upcoming procurement schedule, and we are planning on issuing an RFP for 2020 contracts for the families and children population in greater Minnesota. And we will also be doing a procurement in 2019 for 2020 contracts for our seniors products as well. That one will be statewide. And then anticipate a procurement in 2020 for 2021 contracts, and that will be focused in the metro area for families and children contracts. Now, there have been some changes in the landscape that impact the upcoming procurement since our last big procurement in 2016. There was a federal managed care regulation that was finalized in 2016 that did a lot of different things to help strengthen oversight of managed care organizations, but it focused a couple of elements on procurement specifically. It strengthened conflict of interest protections and reinforced competitive bidding requirements. And it also prohibited states from requiring specific payment rates to providers except under certain limited conditions. And that kind of gets into what Julie was talking about previously. There have also been a couple of state law changes, one of which is in 2017, Minnesota changed state law to allow for-profit health plans to do business in the state. And there's also been a phasing out of certain payments to hospitals that are no longer permitted. So in terms of what the actual RFPs look like themselves, there is our Families and Children RFP, which the majority of the proposal is a quality and service delivery proposal that has several component parts. There is a review of the responder's operational capacity, financial review, required statements, and county questions that are developed by the counties and scored by the counties, state questions developed by DHS, quality and program initiatives, and a network review that's conducted by MDH and also reviewed by our counties. And if a price bid is included, that is scored by DHS. And our seniors RFP is very similar. The quality and service delivery proposal has the same component parts, but of course the questions are really geared towards caring for the seniors population. And there is no price bid for our seniors RFP. So we've included our tentative procurement timeline. We began work on the RFP this past October when we began meeting with counties and regions to talk about the development of the RFP. And that work continued through December when the counties submitted their questions for the RFP to DHS. And we anticipate releasing the RFP early in 2019 for the Families and Children Greater Minnesota procurement and the seniors procurement. Which will then, the responders conference will follow. We are hoping to have proposals due in April, and award letters would be issued in May or June, because then we roll into our annual plan contract negotiations, which begin in July. And that's the conclusion of our prepared remarks.
Members, questions? I know it's a lot. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Benson. I have some questions off topic a little bit, if I could. Is that all right?
Can we do on topic?
Sure.
And then if we haven't gotten to them by 4, we will make sure to do that. I'll start unless Senator Abler. So, Ms. Marquardt, the last time there was procurement, there were some unhappy people, especially at the counties, who felt like DHS didn't include them. Their comments and preferences weren't scored in balance with DHS. And so I'm wondering if you could give the committee a review of some of the problems that happened during that procurement and how you plan to avoid those problems at this time.
Madam Chair, so we at the end of the procurement, which occurred in 2015 for contract year 2016 for families and children, mm-hmm. so the large population, there were a number of counties that were not necessarily completely happy with the results in their county. So we had a variety of some maybe were completely dissatisfied, others maybe there was one plan that they objected to. So there was a variety of what maybe they didn't like. But it basically was one or more counties that you've selected for us are not the counties we think will best serve us. And so there is a state law does outline a mediation process, and we did. And we had used that before. That was not the first time we've ever had mediation. We just had not had mediation with that many counties all at the same time. But also, we had never done a statewide procurement before either. So we had always done procurements in smaller segments. One of the reasons I think that a statewide procurement was chosen, I think, was... or was preferred, and I know that that was something that the legislature and the department worked on as far as that was the approach we were going to take. Doing all of those counties all at the same time is a tremendous amount of work for DHS, for the counties as well. However, from a rate-setting perspective, in getting the rate right, you have economies of scale, you have more data that gives you more confidence that this is the average rate for people. The smaller you make the population, the more difficult it is to even conduct a price bid if you were going to. So I know at that, the intent with that particular procurement was to include a price bid with it. So there's some... whenever we do a procurement under state law, price has to be at least 30% of the consideration. And some of that is figuring out what percentage should that matter? You want to balance cost, but you want to balance it with quality. So if we just simply look at cost and make that too high, we could end up with a very low cost, but not very good service delivery, not very good quality. Counties, we worked with them on a regional basis. And quite honestly, I think it's a lot. Doing it the first time, you're trying to determine what the trade-offs are. And we got a lot of input, and the input was diverse. If you talk to providers in the area, they're regional providers. They provide services on a regional basis too. They serve a lot of counties. They also don't want administrative complexity. So if we are offering them six different health plans in their region, they see that as a barrier to care. We're spending more time trying to figure out how to get the claim paid and less time providing services. Similarly, for enrollees, the continuity of plans within the region, if they happen to live in one county but work in another, the same network is there. So if they receive care closer to work versus closer to home, there's continuity within a network. Likewise, if they move from one county to another, and they're not experiencing that there's a different plan in every county that maybe is in their geographic area. So there's some balance of consistency and continuity. There's some balance of price, and then there's some balance of preference for what the counties, their experience with our health plans and how do they work with them. There are a lot of things the counties partner with the health plans on, and they develop programs together. The intent is never to undermine any one of those things, but each of those has tension. And so you're balancing the tension of all of those things to try to overall, across all of the state, provide a consistent, reliable, high-quality product for people so that people get the care they need. And so we need to make sure that providers want to participate. We need to make sure that counties can administer the program, and some of the parts that they do, they are providers of public health services. They are sometimes the provider. And they have contracts with these organizations, but then they also are the county administering the eligibility and helping people find their transportation. So they're coordinating on that side as well. So I don't know that we would say that we got it perfect. And I don't, you know, there was definitely a lot of confusion at that time about the county board recommendation, the state law, which has not been updated to reflect either the first managed care regulation nor the second, this most recent managed care regulation. So there's a confusion about what is it, how does our state law interact with current federal regulations, and is that clear to everybody? Because we just have not been able to update the state law to reflect maybe the environment that exists and some of the regulatory requirements that the federal government has put onto states. So the board recommendation became, is that the controller? And sometimes that board recommendation conflicted with the scores of that very county. So the people scoring said they wanted this plan, but the board recommendation said something different. And what do you do with that? But then ultimately the decision has to be made by the commissioner. And we can't cede that decision-making authority to counties. One single state agency, the Medicaid agency, has to be the one that makes that decision. So I do think there was room to clarify, and I think when the legislative auditor did a review of that process, I think we were satisfied that we had done the best job we could, recognizing that there was a lack of clarity in some of those things. And so where we could accommodate by maybe adding a third plan, some of those accommodations were made to acknowledge that it's not a perfect system. We don't necessarily have all the clarity we need, and committing to continue to work on that.
Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. And I've got kind of couple clusters of questions. I've got a couple about this, and then you can put me on a list after Senator Dreheim for the one-off ones. I appreciate that.
And so, Senator Matt.
Anyway, just Abler. One's real easy. I just was reading your timeline here. So December says finalize RFP. That's all done then, and you're waiting to mail it out?
Ms. Markworth? I'm sorry, Ms. Weiner.
Madam Chair, Senator. We are close to finalizing the RFP and hope to be able to issue it in the coming weeks.
Right. Senator Abler.
Thanks. Curious. I see real merit in some of the county-based purchasing. They have a good marriage with the counties, and there's no unclarity with those relationships, and maybe we need a law change to clarify the communications that counties and so on need to do, and if we need to upgrade our current law about that, we should talk about that. But it seems like they are kind of a preferred vendor that would be interesting because they're married to the social services and all that, and sometimes it seems like they're not given much credit for that. How do you take into consideration those collateral resources that a vendor like that would have compared to just a regular plan?
Ms. Marquardt?
Or is that, do they get points for that or not?
Madam Chair, you're still speaking about county-based purchasing,
County-based
right?
purchasing.
Okay.
Yes,
yeah, so I do think that we do take into consideration, so in a couple of ways, we have three county-based purchasing plans that are that currently have contracts and that have participated in our programs. And I think the results for them, they had different experiences. And so I think why in some cases the county scores maybe weren't what they expected, and I can't speak to why any county scored the way they scored. We don't overwrite their scores. We don't. We certainly had other plans where the state and the counties were fairly aligned on, right, the value was coming through. And there's always a challenge when you respond to an RFP that if you don't submit it and write it down and say this is what we do and it's conveyed in a way that's effective, the scores can only score what they're presented. So I don't know if part of it was that. But I will say that when we did do the awards, we in counties at that time, the federal regulation required us if you are in a metropolitan statistical area, we had to provide at least two plan options. So counties that had county-based purchasing where they were awarded the contract were given single plan status. And no other health plan that wasn't county-based purchasing was granted that in that statewide procurement. Even though we had done that before, we wanted to make sure that people had options, but we made that special accommodation for county-based purchasing within that, in those counties that we could. And I think there's only three at that time that were in MSAs that where we couldn't give them single plan status.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that. We've both been here a long time, and it's sometimes these award processes are like, oh, here's my application, and you read it as though you never heard of these people before, or at least the reviewers, they never heard of any of our plans. There's no track record. You don't know what's going on. You don't know about the successes they've had in the past, and if they don't write it down right, then it doesn't count. And I find that troubling sometimes, and it's been in many kinds of things, both at the other department and this one, where if you tell a good story, you win. There was at least one circumstance where there was a vendor who was really good at some minority services and some just services of disabilities that didn't tell as good of a story, apparently, as one that was another one that really didn't do as well. And the one that wasn't as good told a better story and got the award, and I find that troubling, and I would like there to be some blank page where our DHS staff, and you're really knowledgeable, could go like, I know what they're doing. And we really, like just the bonus page, where you go like, they should get this because you guys care about our clients as much as we do. But sometimes in the name of whatever this would be, where filling out the paper matters more, we lose the benefit. And that troubles me a lot. And I hope that if you have anything you've learned from the past time, there needs to be a little asterisk page. And you go like, they've been doing this for like 14 years really well, and they've got like this broad coverage. And this group says, I can do it better for $10 per month less. And you pick the $10 per month less, almost sight unseen. So could you please react to that?
Ms. Mockwart.
Madam Chair, I wholeheartedly agree with you that we care as much as you do, and I appreciate that you said that. I would say this. I do. That is always the case when we're dealing with people that we already know, and we will face this in this next procurement. We will have new entrants that we don't know. And so while I agree with you, we want the best product we can possibly purchase at the highest value and price point that we can get it at, as far as, you know, getting those two things right. So I can tell you, and being part of the state development, we tried very hard in that last statewide procurement to create more objective, right? It's not the storytelling. Everybody can spin a good tale, but we ask for more objective measurements. So if you tell us that you pay all your claims on time, what is your metric for clean claims? What's the threshold you use, and how often do you meet it? How much, you know, we can ask questions like, how much interest have you paid, which says you didn't pay a claim on time. But we have to ask questions that any, especially in this next procurement, we will now have potentially new people that we don't know, and we can't disadvantage or advantage one over the other. And it doesn't mean that we don't appreciate or understand or know what people have done, but there is a sense of it that creates an unlevel playing field for anybody new to come in. And I'm not advocating that we need new or looking for new, or I don't know what's going to happen with this procurement, but we are sensitive to the fact that, you know, the legislature changed that for a reason, and we have to accommodate that. So we are, I will say on the state side, we have tried to be more objective, where it's not just a subjective, you know, we're writing a nice report. We're actually trying to use metrics behind that as much as we can.
Senator Abler, you finished, and then close enough. Senator Matthews.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for your presentation here. Actually, one of my questions is the one that Chair Benson asked, but I have a couple more from slide 8 of your presentation, and I don't remember which one of you was presenting on number 8. But on two of your buttons on the page, my first question is on your first button, since I don't have the longevity on this committee like my colleague Senator Abler does. Can you explain to me, like, where federal law requires the procurement process, when that got enacted, a little bit of the story behind that, and if you, or at the very least, provide it to me after the hearing?
Ms. Mockwart?
Madam Chair, we can certainly provide you where that is required in federal law. As we said, it has been a requirement. The most recent regulations have strengthened some of those requirements around what does it mean to have a competitive. And so that means, you know, basically we can't have no standard and hand somebody a contract, but we can certainly give you the federal citation.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Senator Matthews.
And recent, it was when? You said the recent strengthenings of that
Ms.
was
Mockwart.
Roughly when?
Madam Chair, that was the regulations that were finalized in 2016.
Okay.
So we just to be clear, the rules that we were operating under for the 2015 procurement are not the same rules that we will have to operate under this procurement. So some things have changed, some things have been modified, let's say, at the federal level for us. And I also wanted to make sure that under state law, you know, a procurement under state law is also required to be competitive. We can only with explicit permission can we do sole source contracting.
Okay. And one more, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then my second question is on your third button on this page, where the process ensures the highest quality care for the best value. Is this process solely determined within your agency? Is it just your agency that is verifying it and saying it, or are there outside groups that are involved in the process that would, or that see the product of it and would also say the same sentence to us. I'm curious as to if it's coming from just you or if there are other groups around that would say the same thing.
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so there are other folks involved in the procurement and in the scoring. So we have the Department of Health looks at networks, so things that they are have more expertise than we do. So the Department of Health reviews networks, but counties also have historically reviewed networks. Counties have their own set of questions. The state does their own set of questions. And then if it is required, if a plan is coming in and they are required to do a readiness review, the Department of Commerce may also be involved in that from the financial solvency side.
Okay. Thank you. Counties is what I was wondering about, mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Senator Hayden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a slightly different turn on this. We did this some time ago and an MCO got an award and it was, you know, somewhat controversial, and other MCOs didn't get it and were significantly impacted. And then soon after, maybe even a year later, you guys could help me, that same person that was awarded came in and said that they couldn't provide the services because the rate was too low, that they wanted to opt out and renegotiate their rate. So I guess the question is, or if you guys can respond, I mean, it's a little different than the line that we've been going down, but like, how did that happen, I guess, is one. And then, you know, I guess, how do we not do that again? And specifically, Madam Chair, and our good folks, Ms. Marquardt and Weiner, I'm very concerned that now that the for-profits are going to be able to bid on this, and the kind of power that they bring to the table, how do we not get ourselves in a situation again in which they kind of grab the market share and then, you know, cause all this disruption and then come back and say, oh, on second thought, we actually can't make any money at that. We want to renegotiate and then take our vulnerable folks back through a process of trying to find a new partner.
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, you're actually, what you stated was pretty close to what happened. So yes, we did have a plan who withdrew after the first year of the contract, and it was not at the time. It was I guess not anything any of us had anticipated, or we had never had a plan actually withdraw. Nothing like that had ever occurred before, and it was disruptive to enrollees. And I do think that is a takeaway that we have. Certainly, when we look at, so I think the question around that was really the rate. You know, was the rate right? At that time, during that procurement, the rates were set based on competitive price bids. We have to have actuarially sound rates. So our actuaries, before we submit to CMS for approval, have to certify that the rates that we are paying are a reasonable rate that a plan could reasonably cover the costs necessary. The price bid in one particular region was on the low end, but was not outside of actuarially sound. So what goes behind a bid and what a plan might expect to be able to accomplish, like for instance, if they thought they had the ability to perhaps negotiate lower rates with certain providers in a certain geographic region, they may or may not be able to accomplish that. So I think the lesson we learned was, while we don't control that negotiation and what that provider and what the plan might offer, what we need to do behind any price bid is really get more information about the timing of those. What's the expectation of, okay, who do you think, how much is this value, and maybe test some of those expectations a little bit more. It wasn't unreasonable that they couldn't have gotten there, but not achieving your goal still means you're getting less money than you're paying out. And it was never our intent to put anybody in that position, but that's kind of the unintended consequence. So I think our lesson back was working more with our actuaries on testing some of those assumptions that underlie any price bid, and how can you really achieve those?
So,
Senator,
thank you, Madam Chair. So as a follow-up, so when that NCO pulled out, and I know that there was a bit of some litigation involved, and then we went out and got a new MCO to provide that service. Did the price change? Did the cost that we gave the new or the returning MCO, did that change? Did we give them a better deal, or did we give them the same deal we gave the one before, and they just found a better way to, and they just found a way to make it work?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so only in one rate region where that particular plan, it was their price bid that set the rate for that region. Only in that region did we reset. We basically rebased that rate to the second lowest price bid for the plan in that area. And the reason that we did that was because a threshold that we had set within the rates that we pay within any region was there was only 5% difference between what the lowest rate we paid in the region and then the highest rate we paid in that region. The next lowest bid was outside that 5%. So we felt it was appropriate to go to that next lowest bid and have that be the base, and then that rate was offered to the health plans that were in that area. The other thing we did that we accommodated was we had over, I think it was close to 350,000 enrollees who were impacted by that, which means a lot of changes perhaps in networks, providers, drug formularies, things, you know, a lot has to be gone on, and the new plans that we're accepting those members have to weather that transition. And sometimes that means paying out of network providers or paying for a drug that is not your formulary drug, but we need to take time to get the member onto our formulary drug, or we may just honor the pay for that drug that's not on the formulary. So we did provide a temporary adjustment to the plans, but that it followed only the members that transitioned. So they didn't see an increase in the rate for the entire population, but for the transitioning members they got, they received a temporary adjustment associated with those members. So if they took more members, they did see some temporary increase to help cover those transition costs.
And then, Madam Chair, just as more of a last statement, I would hope that we were working really hard to understand what happened, and that now that we're going into a new phase, and I know you guys said you learned from what happened, and that the landscape has changed a little bit. We changed who can kind of bid into this, that we're really – I'm very leery of this. I think that we could have the same thing happen again with, like, large for-profit players, but that's just me. But I would hope that we would just really kind of pay attention to that. And it's much about, you know, the philosophy or my ideology about who should provide health care in this state. It's as much about the patients. It's much about those members, right, that you talk about and all of the various iterations they have to go through just to kind of make sure that their health care is consistent. And I know that this committee is doing a lot of work in trying to figure those issues out on all phases of this. But the disruption to patients and typically those that don't have people who can come here and lobby on their behalf, I think is something that we should flag, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Hayden, for digging deep in this, because I had some questions along the same line. I probably don't share your concerns specifically about the for-profit. I'm more concerned about the process. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm concerned that the process is flawed. And this gets back to the questions I was asking earlier. So you have two ways of providing care to the population that you're talking about. You've got the fee-for-service, and I didn't really feel satisfied that I got the answer. So on the fee-for-service, what is the rate that you pay? Because we need to talk turkey on these things. We know what the commercials do. We know what Medicare does. What is the conversion factor that DHS uses for fee-for-service?
Ms. Markwart?
Madam Chair, we actually have, I believe it's five different conversion factors.
So I'll take them all, please.
I can send them to you. I don't have them off the top of my head. But they are based on, you know, there's one for behavioral health. There's one for primary care. I think there might be one for radiology. But we can send those to you. But I think the other piece that probably is of interest to you is, while that's the professional fee schedule, there are a number of services that we cover that Medicare doesn't cover where they haven't set a relative value. And so we have to set those rates, and that we follow whatever the methodology is that the legislature has laid out. But then I think I don't want to call it mysterious part, but I think it's the less transparent part of our rates are all the add-ons and the rate reductions that have happened over time that have been legislatively mandated are not incorporated into those. So even though you would look and say, you know, in that perfect world where you multiply the RVU by the conversion factor and you end with a rate, there's then also maybe three or four adjustments that happen afterward. And I think that's quite honestly a problem with our rates.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Senator Jensen.
What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to strip away the veil of secrecy that goes on here. And I think it's important for the entire committee to understand. Let's just talk real numbers. So if a person goes in to see a doctor for a sinus infection and gets a mid-level office call, the conversion rate that Medicare uses is $36. You might be able to negotiate with a commercial plan a conversion rate of $56. I'm trying to understand what your conversion factor is, because I think, and I do not mean to speak for Senator Hayden, but what we're doing is, on the fee-for-service side, we're paying on a conversion factor basis, but then we dive into managed care, and I asked you if you know what the managed care organizations are paying the providers for that mid-level office call for a sinus infection. You said no, but we're asking people to squeeze down as low as you could, put a bid in on your request for proposal, so of course, if they want that contract, they're going to push that down. Conceivably, that could narrow the network, because as once they've got the contract, say Blue Cross gets the contract, they'll push it down. And now maybe two-thirds of the providers in that area, say Kitson County, say, no thanks, we're not going to play ball. Now we only have one-third of the providers left. It's been squeezed down. And I think we're treating these patients, they get treated as second-class citizens. We heard John Noseworthy inadvertently get himself in hot water a couple of years ago, where he talked about, certainly we want to focus on the commercial payers versus the MA payers. I mean, there's a reason for that. He wasn't trying to be cruel. He was just commenting on the realities of trying to make a business work. So I've asked you several times in several different ways. So I don't want the five conversion factors. I would just like the one for the family doc seeing Jane Doe for a sinus infection. I think that you should know that conversion factor, and I think we should compare that to the Medicare conversion factor. Because ultimately, when we start talking about single payer or MinCare buy-in, this is critical. Because when Senator Tony Laurie introduced his amendment a couple years ago, the MinCare buy-in wasn't going to use the conversion factor for MA. They raised it to the Medicare rate so that it could work. The only way we can talk about these things intelligently is to have the data in front of us and say, what are you telling us? I mean, there's nothing wrong with just using a sinus infection as an example so we all can get on the same page and feel like we understand. Because this conversation today is going to help shape the way we converse in the future about other options. And I'm not trying to pick on you, Ms. Markwart. You do a very nice job, and I wouldn't want to have to answer my questions. But the fact of the matter is, you're there. So I need to know what the primary care conversion factor is. And I guess I need you to tell me, wasn't it almost able to be predicted that when we went out with an RFP and told groups, If you get the low bid, you get to take care of these people. And to get the low bid, you're going to have to squeeze it down. And when you squeeze it down, we're going to try to pay as little money as possible to the providers who are providing that service for the sinus infection. And the fact of the matter is, we had an insurance company says, whoa, there's no way I can perform according to this. We've got an index of severity. We're not getting any sinus infections. Everybody's got emphysema. And they said, we can't do it. So then you say, shoot a mile. We got 350,000 people we got to cover. So then you go back out and say, we need some help here, folks. And then you raise the ante, and then you get sued for that. I don't think this isn't the way Minnesota leads. We've got to do better. And I'm not just trying to badger you. So if you could just respond to Senator Hayden's question and mine, how do we know this isn't going to happen again in the next 24 months? Not concerned on my part at all about the for-profit. That just isn't a part of the equation.
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, so there's a lot in there. I think to your last statement about how do we ensure that it doesn't happen again, I think that that's part of the decision making which the new administration and quite frankly our new commissioner will be involved in around do you do a price bid. If we do think that the rates are in a reasonable place, what's the purpose of doing the price bid? So a price bid is a tool. And whether we include it or not is a factor to be considered. So if we're not trying to really drive down price anymore, then you may choose not to include a price. But I'm not going to say what the decision is going to be, or I'm not announcing whether we have one or not. But those are the considerations that go into looking at, right, where are we? And as far as the rates that are paid to providers themselves, I can certainly say that the department has been for the last several years advocating for a rate study of our fee-for-service rates. I can tell you that when we do look at what the plans pay relative to that, we do know that a number of plans use that fee-for-service rate as the base of their rate, and they may be adding some percentage to that. That doesn't mean everybody does it on every single category of service, but if we don't have those fee-for-service rates right and where we need them, then we're not. If they're using that as the base of managed care, I would agree. It doesn't flow through right. We're still not right there either, necessarily. So I don't take offense to the fact that people think that our rates may not be exactly where they want to be, because I generally would agree. We do have to, for our fee-for-service rates, submit a report to CMS about where it's basically an access monitoring report, and they use the rate relative to Medicare or commercial as, are you getting sufficient access? And I can tell you that, dental, of course, we are... that we are well on record, and CMS has put us on notice that we are not where we need to be. We are below Medicare rates in nearly every category except mental health.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. And actually, Senator Jensen, Senator Dreheim's been waiting for over a half an hour. And so, okay, briefly, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for accepting an on-topic question versus my colleagues off-topic.
I think I know what Senator Dreheim's question is, and it's relevant. It's just not to these slides. So
Senator Dreheim should feel good that he's off-topic and relevant. Okay. So $36 is a conversion factor for Medicare. About $24 is usually what we see on medical assistance. I asked you before about the managed care contracts, if you know what they're paying. I think in the context of what you said, you thought they were paying similarly to that 24. I really think that if I could, Madam Chair, I would respectfully request a report, maybe identifying just those things. What is the conversion factor that fee-for-service that DHS pays on a fee-for-service? We should know that. And then I think we should know what the MCOs are using for theirs, because I think that there's more to what's going on than meets the eye. I think that I didn't get my answer on whether or not an MCO can come back and ask for more money later on because the index of severity was greater. And if indeed the index of severity was greater, do we have any confidence level that the MCO involved was trying to, as competitively as possible, acquire services for as low a rate as possible, or were they referring within their organization? So if they're getting a mammogram, they might pay $500, but the fact of the matter is down the road, it was $200. And I think these are the things we need to know. And I apologize for being long-winded. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you, Chair Benson. If I could have a little leeway on multiple questions, Chair Benson. Thank you. My topic is the Minnesota Medical Assistance enrollees that have more than one MA ID number. I know you had a meeting here this last week. And, you know, I'm new to this committee, so I apologize if this is off topic. But can you tell me how many ID numbers we have in this system?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, I don't have that in. That I can go back and get an answer to that. It's not in my area, so it's not. I'm not in the eligibility area, so I'm not. I'm not able to give you a number.
Okay. So maybe along with Senator Hayden and Senator Jensen, if you could get us some data on that, I have a series of questions in that, but I won't waste my fellow senators' time with the questions until we get more data. So a follow-up would be wonderful. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Marquardt, could I clarify, do you know if any MA enrollees have duplicate IDs?
Madam Chair, I can confirm that there are duplicates. And to be clear, I'm not... there have always been duplicates in the system even before we converted, but the duplicate ID issue is exacerbated on the current system compared to our old system. So I'm not going to say that there aren't duplicates. There are. I don't have the exact numbers or anything like that, but we do try to make appropriate adjustments where we can identify potential duplicates or highly likely duplicates for the purposes of our risk adjustment and our managed care rates. We have been talking with the plans about what does that mean when we do withhold measurements, when we do quality metrics. It definitely causes issues, and I'm not going to pretend that it doesn't. There are issues that we have to accommodate, and it is a known issue in the system, and there is it certainly is one of the projects on the roadmap to address, among other issues. And I can't really, it's not my, I don't deal in the eligibility area and I'm not on those projects, but that is, I do have to deal with the impact of duplicated IDs.
I believe Senator Dreheim had a follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. So maybe a couple years data, and then maybe how many duplicates were deleted? So what we started with, what we deleted, and then what is the process that you go through to identify duplicates and any proposals on changing how that system works?
Okay, thank you. Ms. Marquardt, do you have clarifying questions about the request?
Madam Chair, I do. As far as deleted, I'm not following. Do you mean when they're merged?
Yeah, when you have a five-year-old kid with three or four ID numbers, what is the process to eliminate the duplicates? What is the process to find them, to identify them? And then what proposals you have to ensure that the duplicates aren't, if there's a process change we can make down the road, that would be great. And then I would love to have this topic come up again when we have that data, if they could come back. Chair.
Thank you. And Senator Dreheim, we're going to have an IT conversation. That might be a good time to revisit this. Senator Jensen.
Madam Chair, this might be a little unusual, but I was wondering if I could ask you, as a senior member of this committee, could you elaborate on what you were thinking about when you asked that question about the number of duplicates? And I don't think we really got an answer from Ms. Marquardt because she said she didn't have that data in front of her, but we have 1 million people approximately on MA or MinCare. Can you just enlighten me a little bit in terms of your concerns in terms of scope and what that means and what kind of dollar savings? Because I need to understand this better.
Sure. Well, I asked the question in a different way. Senator Dreheim asked something very specific, and Ms. Marquardt didn't want to answer the very specific, how many IDs do we have? So I wanted to know if she was aware that there are duplicates. Some people might have five. Some people might have just two. There are some people who just have one. But for claims processing, if you get the wrong ID number for a patient you already served, you don't get paid. Or you have to go through this protracted process. And Ms. Marquardt, maybe you can help the committee understand who issues and is responsible for the ID numbers. Is it the plan or the health provider, or is it DHS?
Madam Chair, so the duplicate IDs that I'm referring to are the what is referred to as the PMIs, which are issued by DHS.
Okay. So, Senator Jensen, what that means is DHS, seeing the same person, has multiple IDs issued, but then they hold the payers accountable for getting the right one. And if the payer gets it wrong, the payer has to do the extra work, which is expensive and burdensome and irritating, and clients don't know why things aren't moving along smoothly. And so I don't know if there's fraud associated with this. I don't know if there's a risk of fraud. But I'd like to get some answers. And at the very least, if we could get it down to one per person, I'd take one per person except for 25% of the population instead of three for some people and one for another. So I'm sorry to be a little bit flippant. We just keep finding these things, and it's so irritating, because if we did this, you know, if you pay under the wrong tax ID, Department of Revenue will clobber you. But when DHS does it, we'll get to it, we hope. So it's probably not world on fire kind of stuff, but it's a problem that's going to need to be solved. And we know Commissioner-designate Lori very well. We know he's a man who scrutinizes things, and so we're going to have a little bit of grace in all of this. Give him a chance to succeed. Senator Dreheim.
Thank you. If I could ask for one more. If you have a list of things that you rate based off of percentages for qualifying for plans that would be affected by those numbers. So the example that I was given would be like vaccines, that if you're going to, so if you have a list of those type of things that you rate, that would be wonderful too. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Abler.
Thanks. And just back to this number thing, is it possible, Ms. Marquardt or whoever, that you could be paying multiple capitations for multiple PMIs to about one person?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, it is possible. However, we within our area, we do look for the potential duplicates, and then we recover the capitations. And our contracts do allow us to recover when we've paid duplicatively.
But you just, Madam Chair, but you just kind of said you didn't know and you're working on it. It's one of the things, it's on the road to success. So do the health plans get assigned a book of business? Do they have a duty to be sure that they're, when you scrutinize their work, do you make sure that they're dealing with actual people who are a single living person?
Ms. Mark,
that they.
Madam Chair, I want to be clear that sometimes, and I'm not an expert on the scope of the duplicate ID, so I just want to be very clear about that, but I'm not steeped in the eligibility system. But I do want to make sure that sometimes the numbers that are said are, it might be a person who has been duplicated since, and they've been on our program since 2014. So they may have had this many IDs between 2014 and now 2019, but they all weren't active necessarily all of those times, nor did they maybe overlap. It may just be that something changed and the next year they came in, and rather than identifying them as this person, they now are issued a new ID, but they were consecutive to one another and no duplication of payment, no nothing. That's a scenario. There are times where they are overlapping and then those issues are encountered. When we issue the capitation, we have a number of circumstances that if we discover that there was an error in that payment, if the person died and it wasn't reported, but we find out, we have the ability to go and recover that. Likewise, with a duplicated ID, if we discover that there were two capitations paid, we can go back and recover a duplicated ID made to the same plan for the same person. It does get complicated when we look at if that person was enrolled in two different health plans using both coverages, to the point of some of this, and again, I don't want to be flip about this, but capitation rate development is based on an average cost of the population. So there's some flexibility or room for, there's some tolerance for error in that is expected when you're working on that level. I'm not here to suggest that we're at an acceptable level of tolerance. I'm not trying to convince you of that. But the rate setting process, folks who maybe are duplicated look like healthy individuals who just aren't using much care. So I would rather get it right. I would rather have everybody unduplicated. I would rather have all of that. I absolutely would. But there are measures and then some adjustments that we use based on the data we have. I don't have visibility to the whole population because I don't, fee-for-service, I don't see what duplicates are there. If someone has a fee-for-service and managed care, I don't know that. I only know who's in the managed care population. And then it's not always as easy to identify duplicates. In some communities where surnames are very common or where people don't have social security numbers that you have other identifiers that you can match on, sometimes confirming, because the last thing you want to do is merge somebody who was actually two people. Now neither of them is getting the right coverage, and we took coverage away from somebody. So that process is not within my area, and I'm happy to give that process to you and get to the right people who can explain that for you. But we are adjusting and making the appropriate adjustments and making the coverages work for people, and where they are interfering with care, those get escalated to the top and they are resolved as quickly as we possibly can.
And thanks, Madam Chair. And you can tell it's on our mind. But it seems like the buck has to stop with somebody, and I think it may be the health plan that should decide that they're serving three people out of the same number. But if it's a fee-for-service or there are two plans and two people in different counties, I think that there's people I can't get out of bed in the morning because they can't find a PCA, and I can't give them raises. And this inappropriate payment is going to divert money from them so I can help these people live their lives. That's on my mind, and it's on your mind too, I know, but I'm just reminding you about how this is not a trivial question, and I'm sure we'll revisit it again. I'll just do one more question.
Thank you, sir.
I have four more. In your evaluation of these plans as they're providing their dossiers on their amazingness, do you ask them about their loss ratios, what they pay in patient care to the providers, never mind the administration amount? You ask them to what their payments to providers are based upon their capitations are. Is that a report, or do you ask them that?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, they report their medical loss ratios on a quarterly basis.
And are those public?
Ms. Marquardt.
Madam Chair, I believe they are.
Oh, I'm really interested. So maybe that could be another memo. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marquardt. Short question, comment, longer question. Short question is, approximately, what is it per member per month? Isn't it a range of $400 to $800 per member per month, depending upon the index of severity of the patient?
Ms. Marquardt?
Madam Chair, so it certainly varies by the contract, but if we're talking families and children, right, it can vary from around maybe $300 for a child to maybe over a little over $1,000 per member per month for an adult without children.
Thank you, ma'am.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So here's a comment. We've been desperately trying to find some money to address the opiate crisis. We know that $20 million would be a real start. So then I run the numbers. We have 1 million people on MA and MinCare. If 0.5% of those folks are either duplicate IDs or people that maybe are on a book of business, as Senator Abler said, but they're not even aware they're on a book of business, so they're not even aware that they're covered. If we just have 0.5% and we multiply that by a lowball member per member per month of $400, even though it could be double that or even triple that, we'd be at $25 million just by cleaning up that 0.5%. So to me, this is just, I mean, because I can't help but think, in the world that I function in, we might well say, okay, sorry, you're not going to like this, but we're going to cut your budget by $25 million because we know that we have a critical need over here. The entire state has said it. Everybody's acknowledged it. So I would say, we're taking $25 million from your budget. Go fix the problem. And I would think that you would say, shoot a mile. We're going to have to go straight towards potential duplicate IDs. We're going to have to make sure that we're not paying MCOs for people that don't even know that they're covered. Is that what you would do, or would you have a different plan?
Ms. Marquardt. Because we're looking for all ideas.
Madam
we'll
Chair,
take that one plus whatever you come up with.
Unfortunately, I'm not. I don't get the power to make that decision. If you're asking me what impacts my business, duplicate IDs is certainly one of the biggest. But I'm certainly not in the position to say what the rest of the agency or the other programs or the counties would identify as their biggest issues, or what MnSure would say are their biggest issues. It's a shared system. It impacts a lot of things, and so. I'm not trying to diminish the impact of this. It is a problem, and I do want to get it fixed. We all want it fixed. But I the plan wouldn't be dictated by me, so I have a hard time saying what that would look like.
And members, just to wrap up, this issue has been raised. We're going to come back and revisit it. I'm going to work with Andrea to try to get this conversation held the same meeting where we talk about the legislative auditor's report on able-bodied adult ineligible people on the system, how that interacts with PDM or periodic data matching, and get an update on PDM as well. The legislative auditor, we had a hearing today over lunch, and the report came out over in December. Everybody was a little busy with Christmas, so we're going to give it some special attention. 15% error rate. Yes, the sample was small, but let's see what we can do to use technology that might be faltering, but we need to get better at this. We need to figure out how to get rid of these duplicate numbers for ease of processing, reduction of risk, reduction of waste, reduction of potential fraud. A lot of money flows through these IT systems. They should work. A lot of money flows through this healthcare system. And we should, some of this feels like low-hanging fruit, frankly. And so anybody who wants to work on it is more than welcome. And with that, members, I appreciate your time today. We have a lot of work ahead of us. We are scheduled for next Tuesday. And staff will put on an announcement on that agenda. With that, thank you, members. We are adjourned.